Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. As you may have noticed, this is our 52nd episode. So although we've technically been doing this for longer than a year, we now officially have a year's worth of episodes. We are here tonight with Molly Tanzer, author of A Pretty Mouth. This is Renee, and I'm drinking a Trout Slayer Wheat Ale. And I know that sounds kind of gross, but when we were at Books and Booze event in St. Louis, the guy at Cicero's got me to try a beer by the same brewery called Moose Drool, and it didn't taste like Moose Drool, so I felt like Trout Slayer wouldn't taste like a trout serial killer or trout. Yeah. Anyway, Molly, how are you doing, and what are you drinking tonight?
I am doing fine, and I am drinking a Chinar and soda, which has been my recent jam. I've been getting super into bitters and soda because it's 1,000 degrees out here in Colorado.
Mm-hmm. And Jessica?
I'm drinking PBR, but I'm drinking it out of a bottle tonight, so.
Ooh, fancy.
I didn't know they made it in bottles.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it comes in bottles.
I had it on draft once. I was, like, super excited. I was like, this is the fanciest that PBR has ever looked in this, like, fit, like really pretty glass.
Oh, yeah.
Dakota, what are you drinking tonight?
I've just been kind of slamming back, you know, different things. Started with Jeremiah Weed Sweet Tea, and now I'm trying a Di Serona with cranberry juice.
Ooh, those are yum.
Yeah. I think I mostly have a sugar high by now, though.
Yeah. It is very sweet, yeah.
Either way, something's going to happen. It's going to be crazy.
I used to drink amaretto sours all the time. Like, that was the first drink I felt okay to order at a bar. So, yeah.
You had a general idea of what was in it, and you were like, okay.
It was sweet, and I was like, I can probably eat with this. You know, I was a beginner.
Yeah. You know what's good? Quokka and pineapple.
What's that?
Quokka, the liquor Quokka, and pineapple juice.
Oh,
Quokka. Yeah, I haven't tried that yet. There's a bottle over at my friend's house, but I haven't known what to do with it. So now I know what to do with it.
Happy to help.
I had Malibu and pineapple earlier today.
Ooh, I don't know about that.
Like, oh, it was yum.
Pina colada, but not frozen.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't frozen. It's just on the rocks. It's just pineapple juice and some rum, you know.
Right, but like a pina colada is rum, pineapple, and coconut. But is coconut rum.
Coconut rum.
I feel like that's weird. It creeps me out a little bit.
Well,
I feel like
sorry.
I can't drink cocktails too much because of my, masculinity and all those things. So I have to drink them at home if I drink them anywhere where nobody can.
Well, now you're
talking about, dude. There's so many manly cocktails out there.
Yeah,
a few.
As we planned.
I can never
order
a hurricane or anything.
No, you gotta order a hurricane. Are you joking? Okay, first, I'm gonna introduce this little segment that we're doing here. As you may or may not know, listeners at home, Molly's a big fan of cocktails and cocktail recipes.
I am.
And a bunch of them at her blog. So this is why we're getting like into a deep discussion about cocktails. And I don't know, maybe it will inspire you to mix something really interesting to play the Books and Booze drinking game at home with us. You got to drink a hurricane. Like when we went to New Orleans, that's all my husband drank. And he's a pretty manly guy. Like he's in the Marine.
And dude, like, I mean, one of my favorite cocktail mixing manuals, my second favorite, I should say, both of my top two were totally written by manly men, and my second favorite was definitely written by, like, some guy who writes for Esquire, and that's, like, I don't know, I hear, like, a pretty manly magazine.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And come on, Ernest Hemingway drank mojitos.
Yeah.
Sugar in.
No, my favorite cocktail manual was written by some guy who knew Ernest Hemingway. It's called, like, The Gentleman's Companion, being like a mix of being a book of cocktail mixing or something. It was written in the 30s by some crazy guy who sailed around the Florida Keys just getting trashed constantly.
So it's
completely fascinating. Yeah.
I want that job.
So a book written by my hero, apparently.
I know, right? And you totally get the vibe sailing around sailing around with, like, no shirt or a shirt unbuttoned to his navel, like, Magnum P.I. style. So, I don't know. I think that's pretty manly.
I feel like he had a lot of chest hair.
Yeah, definitely. And probably a hat.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I should have gave my lying drink. I even had it wrote down, I believe. I was going to say I was actually drinking a martini stirred, not shaken. Since, shaking it bruises the gin, and 007 has no idea what he's talking about. So
it's
I'm sure everyone knows that, just for the amateurs out there, yeah.
Yeah.
I just heard that Dakota plans, but he's going to lie about drinking. Even though every time he's like, I was lying. That's not what I'm drinking at all.
Yeah, I'm lying. I'm actually drinking something worse. I really was drinking Pruno.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you say it bruises the gin? What does that mean?
Nothing.
It's definitely nothing.
It's a myth.
I don't like gin.
Here's one thing.
So
a lot of cocktails, when you shake them with ice, get cloudy. And some people don't like that. Like, for example, like a Sazerac is always supposed to be stirred rather than shaken because it does get cloudy if you shake it. But a lot of the times, the only way to get it as cold as possible is to shake it. And so, like, I don't know, I'm definitely always a coldness and taste over appearance kind of girl when it comes to cocktail making. So I think, like, the bruising the gin myth comes from, I thought it was bruising the vermouth, though, but I could be wrong. I'm not a martini drinker, and so I'm not up on, like, martini myths and legends, but my husband really likes martinis, and he definitely just, like, shakes the stuffing out of them, so.
I have martinis on my chest, and I don't drink martinis. But it's okay, because the guy who did them said that if he did the liquid, the color, that it would be, it would blend in with the glass. So he made it look like there was beer in him anyway.
Hmm. Interesting.
So let's do a quick, like, lightning round. What's everybody's favorite cocktail? Like, I'm going to break it into two categories. What's your absolute favorite, and then what's your go-to? Like, you go to a bar, and this is what you order all the time, and then what's the one that's like, ooh, I really love this one, but I drink it very often. We'll start with Molly, and she's the expert.
Oh, me.
Oh, man. Am I the expert? Oh, my God. Well, I would have to say my favorite cocktail probably is the Corpse Reviver number 2, which is sort of like a complicated concoction involving gin and Lillet Blanc. It's one of the few cocktails that has 5 ingredients or more and is actually good. That's usually like a sign of like a questionable cocktail, in my opinion. But no, it's got like a little bit of absinthe and some Cointreau, and it's always served with like seriously fancy brandied cherry. It was supposed to be like a breakfast drink, which I can't even imagine how drunk people were in like the 20s. But yeah, it's a super good drink. And if I'm at a fancy cocktail place, I do tend to order it as a barometer of whether or not I'm pleased with the bartender or not, which sounds super snooty, but I'm kind of a cocktail snob. But I'm not sure what I always order out. It really depends on the location. I like to order regionally. Like, I just was in the Keys a couple of weeks ago, and I totally just maybe OD'd on painkillers, which are like a rum and coke, like Pusser's rum only. It's a Pusser's cocktail, but it's Pusser's coconut cream and like maybe pineapple juice and orange juice and nutmeg. It's super English, but it'll get you where you need to be. So I don't know if I have a good answer to the second part of that. A painkiller, yeah.
Better than
real
painkillers, then. Yeah,
yeah, they probably would pair nicely, but yeah, the painkiller is pretty ferocious, and it's very like on a tropical island style drink.
So, Dakota, give us your cocktails.
Well, I would have to say if I'm at a bar being sociable, I'm probably wearing a tie, so I like to do the John Draper thing, and I'll order an old fashioned. Let's see, all over favorite cocktail. I'm not much of a bartender, so, and I'm not usually drinking cocktails, so I take a lot of pride in making margaritas with like just rot gut cheap tequila,
nice.
And whatever I can find to make it with. So yeah, I wouldn't recommend anybody else drink it, but I take pride in it, even though it tastes disgusting. Yeah,
yeah.
Horrible.
I actually like the taste of tequila.
Yeah.
I like the taste.
Well, Patron or something maybe. But.
Yeah, I mean, I only have margaritas when I have Mexican food, and I have them on the rock.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jessica,
yeah.
What's your go-to cocktail and what's your favorite cocktail? I think I know your go-to.
Really?
Yeah, because when the show started, you always drank rum and Coke, so I feel like
that's true. That's what I was going to say. Rum and Coke is probably my go-to cocktail right now if I'm going to get a mixed drink. I like rum.
What kind of rum do you prefer?
That really doesn't matter. If I go to the bar, I'll just have whatever, like, this house. I like anything. I'm super easy to please.
Well, let me say this. Bacardi is disgusting. It tastes like pure gasoline.
Because you probably drink 151, right? I know you do well.
No.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Rum and Coke fan myself. That's my go-to. That's what, like, if I don't know, like, what the bar really offers, how good the bartender is, all of that, I'll order a Rum and Coke. But I'm a huge snob about it, so I have to ask them if they use Pepsi or Coke. And if they use, like, just our, like, off-brand cola, then I have to, like, quiz the bartender about whether it tastes more like Pepsi or Coke. And then depending on the answer, I ask for a different rum. If it's Coke, like real Coca-Cola, I always go for Bacardi and Coke with two limes. If it's Pepsi, then I'll go for, like, Malibu or something like that. My favorite is the Dark and Stormy with, like, a really good dark, spicy rum and, like, real ginger beer.
Yeah, definitely. You always have to have the real ginger beer.
And just a tiny bit of, like, a mint leaf to garnish and a little slice of lime.
Huh.
It's so pretty.
Mint.
Yeah, well, I never thought it was mint before, but there's a place that we go to eat sometimes, and I ordered their Dark and Stormy, and it came with a little sprig of mint and a lime and a copper mug.
That sounds really good. Yeah, my favorite Dark and Stormy rum is Kraken.
That's what I was going to say, Kraken.
Yeah, it's super good. It totally stands up to, like, a ferocious ginger beer.
I like Kraken, and I like Sailor Jerry. Sailor Jerry is one of the few rums I'll have with Coke or Pepsi.
Nice.
It's just too good to not have it.
Yeah. Yeah, I usually like either the Kraken
over...
Ooh, Captain Morgan.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I like Captain Morgan more than Sailor Jerry. Ugh.
Really?
If you're talking about...
They're not the same thing. Captain Morgan is... Well, anyway.
Sailor Jerry's is like a hipster rum.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I mean,
but
it's not untrue, but at the same time...
No one disagrees with me, yeah.
No, I don't disagree. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying that that's not necessarily, like, an indicator of quality. Like, for a while, I was suspicious of Kraken because its packaging was just too good. I was like, what are they trying to hide? And then a friend offered me a sip, and I was like, whoa, okay, no, actually, you are, like, validly delicious. So, you know,
that
sometimes...
That is hilarious, because somebody had it at a party we were at, and I had the same line of thinking. I was like, it's, like, too cool looking.
It is too cool looking.
And then you drink it, and you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah, no, it's super good. Like, I definitely have, like, a couple of friends who are purists and, like, only do the Goslings, because Goslings, you know, Goslings ginger beer and Goslings rum is the original, the original Dark and Stormy, with no lime, but I think that's kind of bogus. Like, I'm usually a total traditionalist, but at the same time, like, I really like lime in a Dark and Stormy, and I'm super into just the crazy taste of Kraken, like, overwhelming everything, so.
I like lime in mine, but when I make them at home, I very rarely go through the effort of making sure I have lime. I don't know. This is why I don't drink Corona, because I feel like you can't have Corona without lime.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Lime.
It's weird, go ahead.
I was going to say, we have, like, a Corona in the beer drawer in the fridge for, like, so long that we didn't know how long it had been there because I just kept forgetting to buy lime.
Yeah. No, I'm really lucky. For some reason, like, citrus is cheaper out here in Colorado than it is in Florida, where I grew up. And there's, like, an amazing grocery store that always has, like, $5 for a dollar limes. And so, like, I always have limes in the house. Like, I am never without limes. And their lemon prices are totally decent, too. So I feel like that actually has, like, helped along my cocktail making because I'm never wanting citrus.
I don't know. I'm just lazy about limes. I don't know. They're, like, in a different part of the store than the other stuff I buy. I don't have an excuse. I can't think of very many things that I like to drink aside from beer, which is my go-to, that don't involve lime, and yet I never have it.
Yeah.
But funny story that I have to bring up. I didn't know they were called Dark and Stormies at the time, but my husband is the one who introduced me to rum and ginger beer, and it was the first time we really hung out, and we were waiting for people to meet us for dinner. And they got lost in D.C., and they were hours late, and we finished an entire bottle of rum with, like, a six-pack of ginger beer.
Whoa, ferocious.
Yeah, it was a bad idea. I mean, we're married now, so I guess it wasn't that bad of an idea. But nothing happened that night because we were both too drunk.
It happened.
Oh, man. Cocktail time.
Hopefully no one puked either. Okay. Yeah. That's just alcohol abuse.
I'm not even sure because it was that kind of night. I don't remember if I puked.
Yeah, that's amazing.
move right along before I embarrass myself any further.
So we're talking about Johnny Gibbings porn tonight? I mean Victorian porn?
Come on. Come on.
Okay.
So let's all recover from that and jump right into A Pretty Mouth because in addition to being a fantastic title, it's a wildly great book.
Oh, wow. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
So I guess just to kick things off, we had a listener question that was like, this listener stole my introductory question, which was disappointing for me, but I'll give credit where it's due. She got it first. It's like a patent thing, you know. Abby Mullins, she actually has a series of questions, and I'm going to just break it out so it's a little bit easier. She says, where did the Calabasas come from? What was the idea for the family? And I would modify that to ask if you came up with the idea of writing a series of short stories that all involve different generations of the same family first, or if you started writing and just thought, like, this is too good not to get into.
Okay. Well, that's actually a funny story. So here's the thing. Like, nobody – at the time that I started writing these, the first story that I wrote in the series is The Infernal History of the Ivy Ridge Twins. And that came about because in the circles that I was sort of hanging out in at the time that I wrote it, historical fiction was not – a la mode. Like, people really wanted modern stuff. Like, I'm not talking trash at all. It was just sort of like people wanted like urban fantasy or high fantasy or just kind of different things than like historical pastiche and like weirdness and stuff. But then I saw a call for submission to an anthology that Innsmouth Free Press, a Lovecraftian press, was putting out called it was called Historical Lovecraft, and they wanted historically set Lovecraftian stories. And I was like, well, what's up? Like, I have a master's degree in sort of like 18th century literature, essentially. Like, why not actually use it for something and write a picaresque about necromancers? Because I had been, the story that I've told, which is totally true, is I was watching Barry Lyndon, that old Kubrick film, which isn't very good. And so my mind was wandering and I was like, dude, I should totally write a picaresque with like incestuous twin necromancers. And I really wish I knew how that came to me because it was like one of the few muse moments I can actually like claim. But so I decided to just do it. And in order to do that, I pulled out a bunch of the books that I read for my master's, and Tom Jones was the first one off the shelf because it is like the quintessential picaresque. And I swear, on the first page, there was a footnote about, so he talks about Calipash and Calipee. Calipash and Calipee being the gelatinous, what is it? It's like the gelatinous delicacy found under the shells of the tortoise that I guess English people ate in the 18th century, because all of the discussion about English food is in some way true. Not necessarily its grossness, because I don't want to be, because I've actually some of the best food I've eaten has been in England, but the sort of like interesting choices in terms of dining. And so I looked up the word, and right there it had the definition, calipash and calipee, and I was like, dude, calipash is such a gross, weird, turtle-like thing, and it was very Lovecraftian to my mind, and so it kind of just all spun out from there. And a lot of it really did come out of some of my favorite 18th century novels that I read when I was sort of doing the formal education thing. So that definitely came first. And then after I finished it, I just really liked the world, and I think I had been watching a lot of Blackadder. And I was like, dude, this is like the perfect medium for this family. Like, what if it was some sort of like weird gothic curse, and like, you know, through time, these weird twins appeared out of nowhere because of some sort of family thing. And when Cameron at Lazy Fascist contacted me asking if I would write something, I was like, dude, this is going to be like the perfect project. So I don't know, maybe that's more information than you wanted.
No, that's great.
It actually, what got you interested in the 18th century literature?
Well, it's really random, because I know it is like a strange genre or a strange time period, because, I mean, most of the time when people have read something from the 18th century, they've read like Robinson Crusoe. Because like, I mean, Jane Austen novels are very evocative of 18th century novels, but it's a little late. And so it's a very unread century. And the thing was, like, I was working this job. I know it sounds like a weird instruction, but really, I was working this job. I was doing social work in South Florida, which was, like, unexpected. I hadn't really applied to be a social worker at this organization. I applied to be their PR manager, and they were like, hey, why don't you counsel these girls and go on and, like, take our, like, suicide hotline phone? And I was kind of like, oh, I have an art history degree. Okay, sure. Like, I have a women's studies minor. I'm sure I can handle this. And I was wrong. And so I did what generations of 20-somethings who hate their jobs have done, and I applied to grad school. And I saw this. I had sort of been browsing Florida graduate programs and saw this program in the humanities at Florida State. And they were kind of like, hey, do you not know what you want to do? Come be in our program. Like, we'll let you do whatever you want. Which should have been a warning sign, but I didn't know that at the time. That program no longer has a PhD track. But that's a lot of drama we don't like need to get into. But so I applied and I got in, and I needed to take a lit course to fulfill a requirement. And I ended up in 18th century literature in the English department, and I was sort of like, yeah, I'll try this. I haven't ever read anything from the century that I thought. And it ended up being not only 18th century literature, but like transatlantic literature, so like focusing on the slave trade and Jamaica and slavery and things like that. And I really liked the professor, and I read the first thing that she had on the syllabus, which was a long 18th century, which is like an academic term, meaning like between like 1640 and like 1812 or something. That's a long 18th century. But it was called the Isle of Pines, and it was this weird, I don't even know what you would call it in the modern day, like novella about, that was sort of like a burn on like English colonialism and that way of like old-timey people writing ridiculous things to like, you know, hurt the feelings of other people. And so it's all about like how Dutch colonists are doing a better job in the New World and how English people suck at making colonies. And so it was all about this guy who gets shipwrecked with a bunch of babes and like has sex with them, and then like has a bunch of kids with them, and then their kids have sex with each other and have a bunch of kids, and they form this like weird English colony. And there's a bunch of ugly race politics involved with it too. But I was sort of like, wow, this is seriously the weirdest thing I have ever read. And its proposal of like English pornotopia is bizarre, and it totally hooked me. I stayed in the class. I loved everything we read. I got totally into sentimental literature and like women's sentimental literature and the abolition versus amelioration movement, and like boring, probably to most people. But it just really got its claws into me. And so I stuck with it and had that be the focus of my humanities major when I was in grad school until I left. So that's why 18th century, like a series of random events. Like, I really wish I had a better story, but that's it.
Oh, that's good.
Actually, you just answered one of Abby's question. Well, actually, in the two answers, you answered all three of her questions, so that's awesome.
Oh, wow.
Pick those off the list. But it leads me to the question that I've been dying to ask. As I said, we have like our Dakota, Jessica, and I have our own little Facebook group where we talk about the show and business and all that. And I said, I really want to talk about Victorian porn.
Oh, sure.
Right? Because, as will come to a surprise to no one who pays any attention to my Facebook feed, I read a lot of crack.com, but my favorite one they did was the Ridiculous Sex Myths from History That You Believe, and the first entry was about, you know, you think Victorians were prudes, and then it linked off-site to a bunch of Victorian porn.
Yeah.
And I, wow, right?
Dude, it's raunchy.
And, yeah, well, and this website they linked off-site to is this girl has a blog, and on Fridays she does Victorian Porn Fridays, and she has a whole series of them. I think there's, like, 17 or 18 editions of her Victorian Porn Fridays, and all she does is, like, gives a quick introduction to how crazy this is and how it's not safe for work and probably not safe for life. And then she posts, like, excerpts of Victorian porn. And so, you know, one of the ones...
Dude, no way.
I'll link it up in the episode notes so you can check it out because it's pretty cool.
Yeah, please do.
But, you know, one's like, it's about a guy who's with this woman who's incredibly hairy. And then
In The Romance of Lust.
Maybe.
I think it totally is. Like, there's like an, I think there's like, well, at least there's an extremely hairy woman in The Romance of Lust, and it always kind of stuck with me. Because she has, like, a really prominent clit that, like, she can, like, Roger young girls in the butthole with. Like, it's an amazing sequence.
It's quoted from Memoirs of a Young Raquel.
Oh, dude, no, leave me that. But anyway, if you're into that, I can totally recommend a book for you.
Awesome. But then, you know, there's other ones she links that deal with, like, the slightly more taboo things with, like, incest and, you know, like you said, like, this group of people had sex, and then they had kids who had sex with each other, and so on and so forth. And it's just so wildly different from what we've been conditioned to believe.
Oh, yeah.
And some of it is, like, pretty, I don't know, like, par for the course as far as erotic writing goes, and then some of it is just really mind-blowing.
Yeah. You can find it's really, really interesting stuff. Not just on the titillating level, but on the, like, huh, what? Kind of level too.
And so I guess my question for you is, I'm going to assume that you have more experience with it than I do, because, you know, like, some of it's been written into the story from A Pretty Mouth that I can't remember the name of.
Hour of the Tortoise is the one that's all about Victorian pornography.
Thank you. I knew I had something to do with the tortoise, but then I was, like, second-guessing myself because we were just talking about the gel on the in the tortoise.
Yeah, oh, no worries. Yeah.
But first of all, because I enjoyed that it kind of made a little bit of fun of Jane Austen in there, too, like in the narrator's internal monologue, which I thought was great. And then there's some really powerful stuff in there. But my question for you is, do you have any theory, I guess, on, like, what this particular outlet of the Victorian time, like, meant about their society? Like, because the reason why, I guess I'm asking, is the reason why we believe the myth that they're very sexually repressed is because it was a very proper society publicly, but privately it was a lot different. And so I'm wondering if you have any insight.
Well, I guess I would say that, I don't think I have any insights beyond what's already been said on the matter. I think for people who are curious about just, like, raunchy Victorians, there's a really good book called The Other Victorians that's all about Victorian pornography. It's an academic read, but it's super engaging. I'm actually kind of, like, as I sound weird, it's because I'm scanning my bookshelf for it to see if I can find it and give the author's name, but I can at least provide a link for you to put up in the notes, and it's super Googleable, and it's The Other Victorian. Oh, there it is. Marker. Oh, God. No. shit. Okay. Sorry. Okay.
Yeah, don't knock your bookshelf over on yourself while we're recording.
Yeah, I kind of just did. It's fine. so the other Victorians, the study of sexuality and pornography in mid-19th century England by Stephen Marcus. And it's, I think I got my copy just off of Amazon after someone recommended it to me. I can't remember who. But yeah, it's super good, and it's all about theories of raunch and why raunch became such a major industry. And part of it is that, yeah, like, sorry, I'm trying to pick up somebody's books at the same time, but I'm talking, and I'm not doing a good job. So I think a lot of the theories about it are just that, like, every society has strange outlets in the way that they, what they say and what they do. And the Victorians, like, they did have a lot of these alleged morality codes, especially for young women and marriage politics and things like that. But whatever, I guess I would say my personal theory is, like, whatever is taboo is often most fetishized in just in the human mind. Like, if something is forbidden, we are automatically attracted to it. And so if you say morally and socially it is wrong to have sex with your brother, or another man, or a virgin, or a woman who's already married, then immediately the human brain goes to, like, dude, that would be so totally hot. Not everyone's brain, but enough people that you get these scenarios in a lot of the pornography. And I have a friend who studies Victorian porn. She's actually, she studied at, like, the Kinsey Institute and stuff like that. And she was saying that there's, like, yeah, no, she's really cool. We met in our Victorian literature class in grad school, which was, like, totally focused on, like, desire and disease and, like, syphilis, and it was, like, the most amazing class I ever took. It was so good, but cause it was just super grody. But she was saying, because we were talking about it one time, that a lot of these novels, like, I mentioned The Romance of Lust, and there's another, like, My Secret Life and Randiana, all of these different ones, that are pretty famous out there. The Pearl is a really good example. That was a periodical rather than a novel, but they all have almost like a set schedule of what's going to happen in them. You know there's going to be a deflowering scene. You know there's going to be a boys with boys scene. You know there's going to be a two girls and a boy scene. And the theory about it is that these novels were published, or these periodicals were published, and they were published in that format so people could flip through them and find their jam. Like, I'm super into boys kissing boys. Like, well, you know, you can sort of flip through it and be like, oh, well, like, the young Coxman narrator, whatever his name is, like, has just encountered, like, Mr. So-and-so. Well, they're probably going to fuck. Great. I'm just going to settle in and read this and do what I will with that information, I guess. And so, yeah, a lot of these
tab on a porn site, basically.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it is, like, early tabbing. And so, like, it really was, and if your taste is, like, all things, then you totally have, like, a smorgasbord of, like, just, like, crazy stuff. You know, the Pearl is a really interesting example. Like, that's, and, you know, it's one of those things that's weird to talk about, because, like, I think the guy was cleared, but, like, someone was arrested on, like, child pornography charges for owning a copy of the Pearl in Australia, but it turns out that, like, I think he owned it on his work computer, and his, like, coworkers were trying to nail him on being, like, a creepy pervert or something. But there is a lot of underage stuff in The Pearl. Like, I'm not going to lie, for any listeners who may want to check it out, I think it's totally available online. So if you're creeped out by that, it's probably not anything you want to read when you're in a sexy mood. But I'm not going to say this in The Pearl's defense, but merely to give the context. When it was published, the age of consent in London was 12. And so they definitely take advantage of that. Let's just put that out there. And it's super gross in a lot of ways, but it's also super interesting on an intellectual level. When you're sort of reading this and it's like, oh my God, this is so not okay. And then it's like, well, it's probably not okay then, but it was legally okay. That's even creepier in a lot of ways. But that magazine in particular, like, you flip through just one issue of it and you've got, you know, a story about a guy fucking all of his cousins. You've got a Miss Coote story, and she was a sort of stock pornographic character who is a spanking. She was kind of a dom. She did a lot of birching and spanking and, like, BDSM-style stuff. And then you've got another story that's I'm trying to think of, like, different ones from that. What about, like, Nobles kind of, like, tittering and going to, and then you've got, like, a bunch of, like, excerpts and, like, dirty limericks that are just, like, totally lame and, like, these days, but, like, some of them are actually kind of scatophilic, like, surprisingly, but, like, yeah, you've just got, like, everything in it, and so it's sort of, like, that idea that you could pick up an issue of this from your local bookseller who traded in illicit material, then, like, probably have, like, a couple of nights worth of, like, interesting times. So, I don't know. It's fascinating stuff.
So it's like an encyclopedia of the darkest corners of the internet.
Dude, yeah, it is. And, like, I mean, it's not as, I mean, I've seen some things that I'm not going to say the Victorians would never have imagined, but probably, like, were prevented by there not being things like, I don't know, like, Naruto animation and whatever. Like, I mean, you see, or, like, furries. But then again, I'm sure there were furries back then. I'm not even going to lie. Like, but, you know, you do find weird things on the internet. It's super easy. But at the same time, like, I feel like I've seen even way more perverse things in some of the 99-cent Kindle downloads that I found on Amazon. So, yeah, I don't know. Nothing new under the sun, I guess.
Yeah,
you've got to progress from the weirdness of the Victorians to where we are now and realize there's got to be weirder shit now than there was then.
Yeah. I mean, I found some dark things on the internet, but I think the most disturbed I've ever been has actually been reading something in The Pearl, which, I mean, I guess I don't want to, it's, like, weird. I have, like, extreme ambivalence. Is that even possible? Can you be extremely ambivalent? Towards The Pearl, because I really, there's one writer that I'm pretty sure wrote two of the long form stories in there, one of which is called, like, Sub Umbra or Sport Among the She Noodles, which, like it's a fabulous title to begin with, but then they also did, like, Lady Pokingham or They All Do It, which is, again, like, one of those, like, tee-hee titles, and I think that they're actually very well written. But then there's one called My Grandmother's Tale, which I believe is sort of like the earliest pornography that has, like, a colonial angle. And so there's definitely some, like, icky race politics in that one that just, like, I was reading it one night and I had to set it down and I didn't open it for, like, a couple of weeks because I was just so appalled by it. So, I mean, it's definitely, like, you kind of have to take the Victorians warts and all, and it's totally fine to judge them, I think, in retrospect, but you also just have to understand that this is the culture that they were coming out of and understand that when you dive down into that hole, you're going to find some stuff that lives in holes. Like, I don't know if that makes sense. I've had, like, two
that was a really interesting choice of words considering the topic at hand. I would say the most disturbed I've ever been, I'm about to make, like, a series of really horrible confessions about myself. I used to listen to Opie and Anthony on satellite radio, which, for anybody who's at all familiar with them, did a terribly raunchy show when they were on regular radio, to the point that they got banned from regular radio. And then it was satellite radio where anything went. So then I was a member of their forum, and I made the worst mistake anybody could ever make on the internet, but the one that is so tempting, is someone says, don't click this link, and then they provided a link, and I clicked it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm saying this because you said, oh, it's okay to judge them in retrospect, but you also have to understand that this is the culture they were coming out of and
yeah,
all of that, which begs the question, what was the excuse for what I witnessed that day, which was a clip from a German porn that the title translated to English as The Church of Fudge, and I'll just let everybody's imagination fill in the blanks.
Oh.
The Germans are always, that's a bad indicator anyway, I mean, usually.
Well, I met some Germans at a bar, and they were surprised and horrified that everybody out in the smoking section outside of the bar associated Germans with scat porn. I was like, you might not be familiar with it, but it's one of your country's biggest exports.
Yeah. No, I think there is definitely, like, a reputation thing going on with that. Because it is a stereotype that I, too, have encountered.
Well, I've been unfortunate enough to experience it. And then, of course, I did what any good human does and made my best friend watch it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Of course. tape their reaction.
Couldn't be expected to.
Well, because like misery loves company, you know. Like,
I get fair warning now. I was like, I'm going to show this to you, but it's horrible.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was at a party one time where like the entire party stopped at one moment because somebody insisted that we all watch Cake Farts, which is definitely something that if you Google, you can. Yeah, I think everyone's seen Cake Farts that wants to see Cake Farts at this point. It was a couple of years ago, but it was one of those like, wow, we're really just all sitting around watching this lady fart on a cake.
Right.
I don't know if I could ever do this on my own, but for some reason having 12 people around me all just like screaming really helped with that experience.
So
why do people like watching disgusting things is what I can't figure out.
It's awesome.
It's part of like a special like group mentality thing, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's
well, even the people sitting by themselves, yeah.
Obviously, there are people who watch this when they're sitting by themselves because there's a distinct shortage of parties that I've been to where some kind of really weird porn has been shown.
Yeah.
And yet, it continues to get made, and so that implies that there's money in it.
Yeah, you would think. Probably not enough for everyone involved, but there definitely is some money in it, I'm sure.
Someone's getting
something.
I
can't think of a dollar figure that would make me feel like, let's do that.
No.
It's for the passion of art.
Right.
Art.
If you're really passionate about farting on cake, then it's okay.
I don't know. All of that reminds me, though, is that I haven't been able to make it through 120 days of Sodom yet. Like, I don't know. Just.
Dude, I read a review of that on, like, the AV Club, and I was like, you know what? I totally am going to skip this. I'm going to take a pass. Like, but it may be because I didn't have, like, a party full of people to watch it with me, and I didn't think I could do it on my own. And I knew, I mean, I love my husband, but he's just, like, he sort of is accepting of my, like, weird ...ness and it's just, I mean, he couldn't make it through Two Girls, One Cup. Like, he was just like, turn this off right now. So I knew that there was no way that I was going to be watching that with him.
One thing I'm glad to say that I've never witnessed firsthand is Two Girls, One Cup. Thank the Lord.
It's so boring. Like, it's, I mean, it's the weird, I don't know, the weird part of that, like, not to go back to, like, an internet trend from 5 years ago, was the weird, like, mournful piano music that was playing over it. That, I feel like, was the only reason that video achieved the sensation that it did, because it was so incongruous and, like, so weird, where it was like, what is even happening? Why this music? Girls, why this stuff?
I feel like you're making an argument for Two Girls, One Cup being artful.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that it was really weird.
Well, I did my research, because I was curious that it's actually part of a larger work, and apparently that's like a whole thing. Like, that's just, they push that out of some, yeah, and like the distributors are always getting sued and arrested for putting that stuff out there.
Oh, sure, well, of course.
Somebody out there is passionate about putting it out there, apparently. So.
Yeah, and good for them, I suppose.
So, best segue ever. Molly, I hear you're up for an award.
Oh, yeah, I totally am. Shockingly, enough. The British Fantasy Society has nominated me in the Best Newcomer category, which is, like, totally thrilling. Like, that's awesome.
Okay,
I'm really
hold
excited.
On. I was talking about the Wonderland Award, so could you repeat
what
you said?
Am I up for a Wonderland Award?
Yeah.
Yes.
What? How did, what? Wait a second. Where was this announced?
Hey, I don't know. I'm looking at it.
Oh shit! I'm not like last month, I think.
No, nobody emailed me about this.
That was awesome.
Oh man, I hope I'm.
That's the first time we've ever announced somebody being nominated for an award on the show.
especially that they didn't know. Yeah, for best collection.
No, I'm not nominated for that.
Are you sure?
Yeah, what? Wait a second. What are you talking about? I have not heard this at all. Like,
I am.
Who told you this?
On bizarrocentral.com.
It's
now,
on Bizarro Central.
Is open.
You're lying to me and like messing me up. Like, wait a second. So, okay, so I'm on Bizarre Central. There's some girl in panties that say eat clams because like it's Bizarre Central.
You on Facebook? Here, I'm sending you a link right now.
Yeah, send me a link on Facebook because I totally do not believe you.
So what was this other award that you're up for, the British one?
This is preliminary voting. This isn't like a I'm just eligible.
Well, that's fine. You're eligible.
See, this book's eligible for best collection. I don't think I've been like nominated. I think that's just like a statement that I published a book last year.
Oh my goodness.
Right?
That's awkward, right?
Isn't that what eligible means?
Obviously there've been a lot of collections published in the last year.
Yeah, there's like at least like 1, 2, at least I'm going to say the exact number, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Yeah, dude, there's like 8 up here, and I'm like, whoa, 3 by Anderson Prunty, prolific dude, no, 4, well, prolific person. Yeah, I don't know, I think this just means that like I could possibly be nominated for like preliminary voting, right?
Well, I feel like it's a bigger deal.
Anyway,
having published the book.
No, I'm not putting it down. Like, I would be thrilled to be on the short list. I just thought it was like, hey, you guys, if you wanted to vote, then you could vote for these if you felt like it.
Yes.
I could be wrong. You guys might be more of an authority than me.
So what was it you were saying?
Yeah, the British what?
Oh, okay, so I am indeed nominated. I am on a short list, if not this short list. So the British Fantasy Society presents an award at their annual con, which is going to be World Fantasy this year. World Fantasy Convention is going to be in Brighton, and they're partnering with the British Fantasy Society, and I have been nominated in the Best Newcomer category. And so I'm totally going to go to England because, like, I can't really bank on being nominated for awards all the time. So I'm gonna do this.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's totally exciting. So,
I
don't know.
To talk about it because I didn't know.
Oh.
I didn't know that one. But, no, that's incredibly cool. And you've got something new coming out in an anthology about mummies. Am I right about that?
I do have a mummy story coming out. So there's an award called the Kitschy Award, which is put out by these people, Jared and Anne, who are super awesome. They run a site called Porno Kitsch. I guess I can provide a link to that because I'm probably not enunciating it properly. But yeah, they're really cool, and they blog about all kinds of stuff. And they run an imprint called Jurassic London, and they do a bunch of charity anthologies. And so the latest one that they're putting out is called The Book of the Dead, and it's all about mummies. And it's going to benefit the British Archaeological Society or something?
Oh, really?
Yeah, so like all proceeds go to benefit the Egypt Exploration Society. It is an English Egyptian archaeological society. I'm just going to say that. And then in the show notes, like, I'm not going to actually Google this right now because I'm a slow typer. But yeah, it's really cool. My story is sort of about like Nyarlathotep, sort of, and sort of about maybe his cat. Because of course, if you're like an ancient Egyptian pharaoh, you're totally going to have like a pet cat, I guess,
right.
If you're an elder god. So yeah, they're actually up for an award too. They're up for a British Fantasy Award as well, but in like nonfiction category or something like that. So yeah, they're really, really, really good people and do a lot of cool stuff. And they put out, I think they just put out one that was like, it benefits like astronomy and astronomical society called like the Lowest Heaven or something. So they're always doing fun stuff like that. So that should be really cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So, my question, I guess, is this is something that I missed because I am not big on 18th century fiction, unfortunately. Although now I feel compelled to become like a huge fan. Like I want to go out and buy a bunch of books. But one thing that was the dots were put together for me later was that the first story in A Pretty Mouth was actually very heavily influenced by P.G. Wodehouse.
Yes, definitely.
And now I feel like this is a weird question because we've kind of answered it, but not so specifically. I was wondering if this was something that kind of just fit what you wanted to do with that story, or if reading P.G. Wodehouse made you want to write that story. I guess it's kind of a chicken or the egg question here.
It is a chicken. Yeah, I'm not sure. I was definitely, so, yeah, I love Wodehouse. Like, I think he's super awesome, and I really, really like his, there's a simplicity to his storytelling, to his narrative that I think is, like, so appealing. Like, he just, like, puts, like, they're formulaic, but they're amazingly good, and it's the language, I think, that really carries them. Like, for, I mean, that's the reason there's one Jeeves story that's a novel that doesn't have Birdie in it, and I'm just not as necessarily as into it. I can't remember, it's not Ring for Jeeves. I can't remember which one it is. But all the G stories and the longer ones, the novels, I think just Bertie Wooster's voice is so engaging. And I think that's why the TV show works so well, that Hugh Laurie does such a good job portraying Bertie Wooster. And, of course, you know, Stephen Fry's Jeeves is amazing. And I was watching a bunch of those because my husband had bought them. He's super into Wodehouse. He owns, like, all these ridiculous pajamas and drinks, like, brandy and soda and all the strange stuff. And so I was sort of... Yeah, well, no, he doesn't have one of those yet, but he totally does smoke his corncob pipe sitting on our porch wearing this sweater with anchors on it and his captain's hat, which is, like, the most amazing thing, and I should probably take a picture of it and post it to the internet because that is what one does in this day and age. But he does have pajamas and, like checked flannel pajamas that he wears and smokes pipes outside in the wintertime, so it's, like, close. But, yeah, he's a weirdo. So that's why I love him. But, yeah, no, we were watching a bunch of those, and I started reading them because I was just like, man, I should totally, like, brush up on my Wodehouse, and then was like, this is amazing. This is so super-duper cool. And I couldn't think of anything that had been really told from Jeeves' perspective. Like, even the Alan Moore Wodehouse pastiche, which the name is escaping me right now, but it's in The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. There's, like, it's Wekko, Gods of the Abyss. Because Alan Moore is awesome. But, I mean, even that is still Birdie again. And so I kind of was inspired to take on a Jeeves voice and do something cool with that. And so that was sort of how that came about. It was just like a storm of, like, huh, this is cool. Huh, what could I do with this? Like, huh, I'm supposed to be writing, like, something. And I was trying to find, you know, when I set out to do A Pretty Mouth, the collection, I really wanted to have very different time periods because I know not everyone is able to, I know not everyone is, like, super into English literature, and this was in a lot of ways, like, an ode to my time in graduate school, and so I wanted to have it be as clear as possible for people who weren't necessarily, like, dorking out over Victorian porn or, like, wigs or, you know, John Wilmot or whatever. So, you know, I just wanted to have it be as distinct as possible, and so I thought maybe, like, a Interbellum story would be, like, a fun contrast to the rest of them, which are much more old-timey, obviously.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's funny, too, is that you were saying how you use a lot of different time periods, and one thing I found, I'm married to a British guy, so I have my fair amount of, I guess, experience with the British humor and the American humor. And one thing I thought that was really funny is that there was some criticism that it all came from British people about how you didn't use the appropriate language in the Oxford story. Modern terms. And then the Americans that reviewed it were like, it was great the way that she mixed this historical context with all of the modern language. And I don't know, for some reason it just really cracked me up because it was like, well, that's the cultural difference in a nutshell right there.
Yeah, it was interesting. I've seen some, I mean, people, that's the thing, like, I really wanted, I mean, like, the title novella, A Pretty Mouth, is probably, I mean, it's definitely, like, my favorite thing I've ever written. Like, it's like, totally my subconscious just, like, out there on the page for everyone, where it's like, oh, who's who, and, like, oh, like, just the horrible protagonist who nobody likes because we were all probably that guy at some point. who, like, drop their uncool friend to, like, why be with cool people or, like, whatever, because it's awkward being a teenager. But I wanted it to be evocative of, like, a million different things at once. And so it was funny. Like, I definitely got a review that was, like, these are such anachronisms. And I was like, dude, I know that people didn't have posters of poets on their walls in the 17th century. Like,
yeah.
Freaking duh. Like, at least give me that much credit. Like, you mean, like, come on. But I just thought it was, I don't know. Like, most of the time when I write something, it's because I think it's funny. And the notion of, like, a bunch of, like, wig-wearing teenagers, you know, at what we would, with sort of like high school, but was definitely college then, like, you know, being sort of modern secret history style people, like, you know, disaffected rich kids, I was like, this is going to be totally funny, and people either like it or they don't, and I'm totally fine with people not liking it, because I'm amazed that people have liked it as much as they did. I expected most people to be like, this is the most self-indulgent thing anyone's ever written, and they wouldn't be wrong. But yeah, it was sort of like, it was always supposed to be about the, like, the yuck yucks. I don't know. Like,
I think the favorite review I came across was somebody that was criticizing the dialogue, but then, like, seemed genuinely confused because you had gotten, the language right in the prose. And it was like, that might be a clue that you're missing the joke.
Yeah, I know. It's like, no, he didn't say busted. In you know, the restoration, like, I friggin' know, but, like, you know, whatever. And there was, like, another person that got mad because, like, in the Roman story, Petronius talks about, like, how well his book sold and his publishers being really happy. And it's like, no, I know. Like, trust me. I taught, like, ancient humanities at FSU for, like, a couple of semesters. Like, I am really aware when the printing press was invented. And this is, like, a joke about writers. Like, have you, like, come on, like, give me a little credit here, like, but whatever, like, you know, again, like I said, like, it is, I feel like people who are going to like it, and people who are going to hate it, you know, get all, like, frowny-faced about it, and that's totally fine, like, I don't expect everyone to just, like, fawn all over me and love me, because I'm, like, so witty, and so, whatever, like, enough people have liked it that I'm very happy with the book, and I was happy with it before people liked it, because it was always supposed to be, like, silly stuff that I thought of this one time. I don't know, like,
yeah
I
love that.
I was wondering what inspired the title of the book.
So I'm obsessed with John Wilmot, the second Earl of Rochester. I've written a couple of things about him, and he's kind of heinous, but he just has, like, the prettiest mouth. And initially, when I was going to write the novella, he was going to be, like, so Henry was going to be John Wilmot. Like, that was totally going to be John Wilmot. And then when I was reading this biography, I realized he was 12, and I was like, like, no, I know where I'm going with this, and I'm just not comfortable with his age. And so he became, like, a secondary character, and I invented Henry out of, you know, my imagination, whatever. But I still like this notion of just, like, the perviness of John Wilmot's poetry and the way that he sort of talks about, like, young men at that time. And it's interesting the way that, like, certain features become fetishized in different time periods, and, like, lips and eyes and, like, you know, men's calves are, like, a big fetish object in the 18th century. Like, a little bit later, like, men's calves totally go on display as this, like, awesome thing. Like, you can't be a good footman unless you have, like, a well-turned calf. And so I was kind of just thinking about, like, the way that individual body parts become, like, this focal point for general perviness and, like, seductiveness. And so, I don't know, it just really fit in my mind for what was going on in that story. But, like, I had a friend caution me that, like, if I named it that, then people would talk about, like, my pretty mouth. And that has indeed happened a few times. And, like, I'm not saying that I actually have one, but rather it's just that people like to make inappropriate jokes.
Yeah.
Which is fine, whatever. There's several inappropriate jokes in my book, so I'm sure I deserve it. But I don't know. I was trying to come up with, like, a good title, and I was like, dude, I'm going to just stick with this. Like, John Wilmot's lips have always sort of had this, like, hold on my imagination, so I'm going to go with this. I wish I had better stories for you guys. I'm sorry.
I told someone they had a pretty mouth once, and they punched me in my mouth.
Well, it does have a deliverance connotation.
I was like, was it inspired by deliverance, or
I mean,
or
not as such.
Context,
yeah, I don't know. If I pretended to have like a better idea of like why I write the things that I do, I'd probably be like a better guest on your podcast. But it's just sort of like things come to me, and then I'm like, oh yeah, that's totally a good idea. Yeah, let's definitely do that. Like, there's really not. I don't know. I'm not the most thoughtful person.
We spent the majority of the show talking about weird porn. I think you're going to be a favorite guest on the podcast.
Ooh, yay. Lowest common denominator. That's where I totally made my living.
I don't even know how you tag that, you know, I don't know.
I'm gonna take a chance and tag it porn and see what happens. It might be our most wildly popular episode yet.
There you go.
So we have this joke that Sean Leonard is our unofficial interview writer for the show, because he always comes up with great listener questions, and I think his two are fun. So he says,
yeah, we are.
Everyone asks about books. I read where Holly is a Hong Kong cinema enthusiast and watcher of movies of questionable quality. I'd like to hear some of her favorites. And then what I would ask be maybe your first answer leading in. Have you seen Student Bodies? And if so, do you consider it a great movie or the greatest movie?
You know, I saw that and I was like, I'm totally going to check out this movie. I haven't even Googled it yet. No, I have not seen it, but I am really excited to look at this because it seems to be school-themed, and I love school-themed trash cinema and horror movies, so I'm definitely going to check it out.
It's really, really good.
Ooh, okay. I'm excited.
It's
maybe
fun.
Now I have like a weekend in front of me. Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to have fun with that.
Yay.
So your favorite... So I guess it's kind of, you can take this either way. I don't know if he means your favorite Hong Kong cinema movie or your favorite movie of questionable quality, but you could answer either or both.
Yeah, I don't know. Hong Kong cinema is one of those things that I have found endless... I don't even know. I freaking love Hong Kong cinema, man. Like, Hong Kong cinema is the greatest. It's so good. I mean, I've been super into Korean cinema recently, too, but there's something about Hong Kong cinema of the 80s and early 90s that just gets me in the right place. And there's so many titles, like Duel to the Death is amazing, because it's, like, Kung Fu versus, like, samurais. And so, like, I mean, it's definitely, like, of that kind of appeal. But I have to say my favorite Hong Kong cinema movie has got to be Mr. Vampire. It's probably my favorite vampire movie, which probably is like a low thing to say, but it's so good. It's about Chinese vampires, which they're sort of like a cross between a zombie and a vampire, but they hop and they can like sense you breathing, and they can be vanquished by like Taoist priests, and they are in this movie. And so it's freaking great. It's like such a weird romp. There's like six Mr. Vampire movies, and I've watched them all, including there's a sequel to Mr. Vampire called, I think it's called Crazy Safari, which actually stars the Bushman from The Gods Must Be Crazy. Like, that movie was super popular in China, and so they sought him out and filmed a Chinese Hong Kong vampire movie with him in it, where, like, a vampire crash lands in Africa with a Taoist priest as well, and, like, hilarity ensues. I don't even know if that... It's on YouTube. People should check it out. Like, it's super weird. And that's the, I mean, the thing that I think is so charming about Hong Kong cinema is that oftentimes it just has everything. There's usually, like, some kung fu, and there's some comedy, and there's drama, and there's, you know, romance. It's kind of, like, just a hodgepodge in a lot of some of my favorite movies. And it's just really good stuff. I mean, and there's more, I mean, I guess I can't say The Hero is a Hong Kong movie because it was, like, a mainland China film. But, I mean, you think about, like, Chinese cinema, and you think about things like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which is in a lot of ways, like, an ode to Hong Kong cinema. And Hero, of course, was super popular and is really, really beautiful and good. But there's something about, like, that, the little cheesier 80s and 90s stuff that just is so fun. Like, Moon Warriors is a really great one that has Maggie Cheung, who is in Hero. And that one has, like, Andy Lau acting opposite a trained orca. It's just like, if that sounds like something that you would like, if like Kung Fu Bandits and a trained killer whale sound like your jam, that movie is for you. And so, I don't know, like, it's just super good. I love Hong Kong cinema, and I kept meaning to vlog about it this year, but I got distracted because I have a low attention span. But, no, I watch it all the time, and it's fun, and you can find better quality bootlegs, and sometimes they actually have American releases. So check your local video store, because they usually have a good collection that someone high ordered, like in the 80s. And so it's really good. In terms of my favorite terrible movie, I'm totally going to go with Tank Girl, because I just can't. I feel like everything that I do is a response to watching Tank Girl when I was 15 or whatever, when that movie came out. And I would never want to answer the question of whether it's a feminist film. It's certainly trying to be, maybe like Catwoman tries to be a feminist film. And I think it's marginally more successful, which is not really the damning with some faint praise, I guess. But, man, when I saw, like, Lori Petty with that shaved head and those terrible clothes riding around a tank in the desert with Naomi Watts, I was like, except for, like, Sailor Moon, this is everything I ever wanted, like, from anything.
I don't know if this is common knowledge or not, but at least in the Marine Corps, women aren't allowed to serve in tank units.
Huh.
But my last year in the Marine Corps was reserve time, and they just had to kind of put me somewhere close to where I was moving because that's part of the contract. And mm-hmm. I got stuck behind a desk at a tank unit, but I got to do some really cool stuff. And I didn't think about Tank Girl at the time. I just thought about how cool it was. It's like I walk out of my office, and there'd just be a tank sitting there.
That's
and we
awesome.
Go out to the field, and there's tanks, like, firing with giant ammunition.
What?
Yeah. Who
That's
doesn't
awesome.
Want that to be a part of their life? It's a tank firing a giant gun.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to rewatch Tank Girl now. I haven't seen it for...
Dude, it's terrible. Like, I own it on DVD because of course I do. But, like, I mean, it's... I mean, you watch it now and it's like, how is this movie in theaters? And it was like a ginormous flop. Like, I mean, nobody went to see that movie. And people who did hated it. But I maintain... There are pleasures there. I mean, it's kind of a soundtrack that is like Veruca Salt and Belly and all these people that I listened to when I was in high school. And it's like, oh, my God, it's such a 90s nostalgia fest. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It's great. It's terrible.
I understand.
Hey, how are we on time right now?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're probably out, but, you know.
We've got 5 minutes, guys.
Can I be a writer for a second and plug something?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm only doing this. I'm usually super terrible about, well, I don't know, I guess I've been talking about myself for an hour, but about, like, pitching things, but it's, so I have, like, a cocktails and literature-themed collection coming out, which I feel like your readership, or your listenership, I should say, might be interested in, given the theme of your podcast. But, like, later this year, I have a collection of my short fiction coming out through Aegeus Press, which is it's a British press, and it's going to be a limited-run 250-book hardcover collection of, like, my earlier short fiction plus, like, a new Lovecraftian story that's sort of more cosmic horror theme than my usual Lovecraft jam, and a new novella it's historical. It's set in the 18th century, and it's about... the Countess Saint-Germain, who is this, like, legendary historical weirdo, but it's sort of like Rashomon, like, it's like, oh, people have different experiences of a weird night at a fop party, but the reason I mention it is that I'm either putting in have invented cocktail recipes to go with all the different stories, so it'll be sort of like a collection of my cocktail recipes as well. Like, there's one... story that I have that was called Go, 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 Said the Bayeki. It's another Lovecraftian story, but it's set in Turkey, post-apocalyptic Turkey, but Turkey. And so there's a cocktail with rakı, which is sort of a native Turkish spirit that I made up. And the 18th century one will have, like, a good recipe for planner's punch. So that may be of interest to your listenership who are into books and booze. Do you see how I did that? That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Excited. I like that.
Yeah, so it'll be called Rumbullion. Rumbullion and Other Liminal Libations is going to be the title. We just settled on that today, me and my publisher. So, Rumbullion? Rumbullion's like an archaic word for rum, but it also means like a fight or like a brawl, perhaps. It's like an old-timey British word. Yeah, Rumbullion.
I like that word.
Yeah, no, it's super cool.
I'm going to say it again when I'm sober and see how it sounds, but...
Yeah, go for it.
Right now, I
super like
that. Just
popped on Facebook to remind me that we did not start on the hour.
Okay.
Yeah, we've been going.
So when I was saying that we had 5 minutes, I think we're like 20 minutes over.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry. I chatter endlessly when I'm given the opportunity
no,
to talk about wigs and shit, so.
It was great. I was just
it's
in
awesome.
Outer space. Like, I just assumed that we started at 8 for some reason, even though we never do.
Good deal.
So it's going to be an extra long episode. It's fine. We paid for the extra storage on our hosting thing in advance, so we'll just... We'll call this a very special episode of Books and Booze.
Ooh, yay. Well, thank you so much for having me on. This was super-duper fun.
Oh, well, thank
yeah,
you for being here. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. No, it was my pleasure.
You're
yeah,
absolutely
that was...
welcome back.
Oh, yay.
Have something new. Yeah. It's tons
yeah.
of fun.
For sure. Yeah, I'll send you guys, when it has a link and stuff, I'll definitely send it along. But, yeah, it's going to be gorgeous. Agaeus always puts out absolutely gorgeous volumes, and it's going to have, like, thin papers and, like, special fonts and, like, all that nonsense. So if you're into that kind of thing, it should be pretty sweet.
So just an update for listeners at home. I'm not going to tack a song onto the end of this episode because I worry that the length might feel intimidating or something. So we're not going to listen to music. We're going to link everything up that we discussed, and we will be back next week, as we always are. And, yeah, so finish your drink in silence this week.
Yay.
Yay.
Yay.